Hey there. Today, we're building a study guide, kind of like a cheat sheet for understanding culture. We're doing a deep dive on the Culture Mapping Lecture Series. So get ready to explore PESEL, Hosteed, the Johari Window, you know, all those frameworks, and then obviously culture mapping itself.
Yeah, these tools are great for decoding cultural trends, but it's important to remember they're just the first step. The real goal is to understand the story behind the data.
Okay, I like that. So we're not just looking at a trend in isolation, right? It's like we're trying to figure out what that trend tells us about the bigger picture, about the culture itself.
Yeah, exactly. Think of trends as clues. Like, what do they reveal about what's really going on? How are people thinking? Why are they making the decisions they're making? Like, what can we really learn about work habits, let's say, or how people live in cities just by looking at, I don't know, the rise of food trucks?
It's like being a cultural detective, right?
Yeah.
We're searching for clues, those aha moments that help us understand human behavior.
And just like detectives, we need to look at everything, not just the numbers. Understanding a culture means understanding its history, its language, its art. We need to see the world through their eyes.
So it's that difference between seeing the data and actually getting the story behind it, right?
Exactly. Let's say we're looking at, I don't know, the rise of esports. If we just looked at the numbers, we might see how many people are watching or how much money it's making. But to really get it, we need to look at the cultural stuff too. Like, how did gaming go from this niche thing to a legitimate sport? What's the deal with streaming and how has that changed things? We need to think about the generation that grew up online and why this appeals to them.
We need to connect those dots, right? All those different pieces of information to see the bigger picture. So where do we even begin?
Well, a good place to start is with something called PESEL. It stands for political, economic, social, technological, legal, and environmental. It helps us break down all those outside factors that influence a trend.
Okay, so it's like a checklist, something to make sure we're considering all the forces at play. So using our esports example, what would that look like?
Okay, so the P, that's political. We've got to look at government policies, right? Some governments have really embraced esports, like South Korea. They've been amazing. They fund it. They provide infrastructure. They even recognize it as a real sport. And you can see how that's made them a powerhouse in the esports world.
So even something as simple as playing video games, it's not so simple after all, right? There are all these other forces at work.
Exactly. E is for economics. And the esports industry is huge. We're talking billions of dollars. Think sponsorships, media rights, all that.
It's practically a global phenomenon now with its own economy. What about the social side of things?
That's our S, social. Esports has built these incredible communities all over the world, people connecting over their love of gaming. It's gone mainstream.
No more hiding in the basement.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got political, economic, social. What about technological?
Well, I mean, tech is everything in esports. High-speed internet, those crazy gaming PCs, streaming. Plus, we're seeing VR and AR popping up, which is just going to blow things wide open.
Tech really is changing the game, literally. Okay, L, legal.
yes, the law. Always playing catch-up. As esports gets bigger, there are more and more legal questions like intellectual property, contracts for the players, what to do about gambling. It's a work in progress for sure.
Like the Wild West, but with more avatars. And finally, environmental. How does that fit in with esports?
Well, it might not seem obvious, but there's an environmental impact to consider too. Those gaming rigs use a lot of energy, and then there are data centers. Plus, we need to think about e-waste from old equipment and how sustainable the manufacturing process is.
Right, it's a good reminder that we need to be environmentally conscious in the digital world too. Okay, so PESEL, that's our tool for looking at the big picture, those external forces. But what about actually understanding the culture itself, like its values? How do we do that?
That's where Hofstede's cultural dimensions come in. Think of it like this. They help us compare different cultures. Why do people from different backgrounds react differently to the same trend? This helps us answer that.
Instead of just looking at what's happening, we want to understand why it's happening.
Right. One of Hofstede's dimensions is called power distance. It measures how comfortable a culture is with hierarchy. Cultures with a high power distance, like a lot of Asian countries, they really respect authority and understand social hierarchy.
So in those cultures, something might become trendy because an authority figure endorses it or because it reinforces the existing power structures. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Another important one is individualism versus collectivism. You know, individualistic cultures like the U.S., they prioritize personal goals, being independent, all that. But collectivist cultures, think Latin America or Asia, they really value group harmony.
Okay, so a trend that's all about, like, be your own boss, That might work in an individualistic culture, but not so much in a collectivist one. They might prefer something that promotes connection.
Exactly. Then you've got masculinity versus femininity. It's basically about what a culture values: competition, achievement, material success, or things like caring for others and quality of life.
So a very masculine culture might gravitate towards trends about status and competition. And a more feminine one might be more into things about, I don't know, well-being and connection.
Yeah, you're getting it. Then there's uncertainty avoidance. Basically, how comfortable are people with ambiguity, with risk? Some cultures, like Japan, they like clear rules and structures, while others are more go with the flow.
So a trend that really shakes things up. That might be a hard sell in a culture with high uncertainty avoidance. But a culture that's more open to new things, they might be all over it.
Exactly. And finally, long-term orientation versus short-term orientation. Basically, how does a culture think about time? Long-term orientation cultures like China, they think about the future, about saving. Short-term, it's more about the here and now.
So a trend that requires a big commitment, that might do well in a long-term culture, but a short-term culture, they might want to see the benefits right away.
You got it. It's super important to remember that these dimensions aren't set in stone. People fall all along the spectrum, but it's a great starting point for understanding how culture shapes how we see the world.
It's like having a cheat sheet for understanding different cultures.
Exactly. Now, let's shift gears a bit and talk about the Johari window. It's about understanding what we know and what we don't know, especially our own blind spots.
Blind spots sounds a little dangerous.
They can be. Imagine a brand trying to reach a new audience. They think they know what makes these people tick, but they're missing something crucial. The campaign flops, nobody's happy.
Ouch. Okay, so how does this Johari window help us avoid that kind of disaster?
It's all about the quadrants. First, you've got the arena. That's the stuff we know about ourselves and others know about us. Our skills, our public persona, all of that.
So that's the stuff everyone sees, our public face. What about quadrant number two?
That's our blind spot. It's what other people know about us, but we don't see ourselves. Maybe it's a bias we have or a bad habit. It could even be our own potential that we haven't tapped into yet.
I guess that's what friends are for, right? To give us that feedback, even if we don't always want to hear it.
You got it. Feedback is key for growth. Now, the third quadrant, that's the facade. The stuff we know about ourselves, but we keep hidden. A secret talent, a fear, a goal we're not ready to share yet.
The stuff we keep close to our chest. Only share it when we're ready. What's the last one?
The unknown. The stuff that nobody knows, not even us. Untapped potential. Hidden talents.
It's exciting, really.
The blank page of our lives. But how do we actually use this? The Johari window, I mean. How does it help us with understanding culture?
It's all about self-awareness and good communication. If we understand our own blind spots and are open to what others tell us, we become better communicators. We build stronger relationships. And when you're trying to understand another culture, that's huge. So by being more open, we can bridge cultural gaps, see each other's perspectives.
Exactly. We all have blind spots. The only way to get past them is by talking to each other and being willing to learn.
I can get behind that.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got Pessel for those big picture forces. We've got Hofstede for understanding values. And we've got Johari for our blind spots. How does culture mapping bring all of this together?
Culture mapping is all about the big picture. It's about understanding how all these things, values, politics, people's actual experiences, come together to create a culture. We use this visual map to track trends, cultural codes, all of that. And then we can even start to anticipate what might happen in the future.
So it's like we're taking all these different pieces of information and building a roadmap to make sense of it all.
Precisely. Think of it like a jigsaw puzzle. Each piece is a different part of a culture. And when you put them all together, you see the whole picture.
That's a great way to think about it. Okay, so we've laid the groundwork. We've got these tools. Let's look at some real-world examples.
Let's start with something everyone's talking about: electric vehicles. We'll look at the U.S. and China. Two very different cultures, but both dealing with this big shift in technology.
Okay, two very different cultures. One very interesting trend. Where do we even start?
We can use Pessel to figure out what's driving the EV market in each country.
All right, so let's start with the U.S. What are the key Pessel factors there?
Okay. Politically, it's complicated. Some politicians love EVs, others not so much. There have been different policies around fuel efficiency, incentives for buying EVs. It's all over the place. Economically, the U.S. car market really listens to what consumers want. And what do they want? Big cars, SUVs, trucks.
That love of big cars, it's pretty ingrained in American culture, isn't it? It's about freedom, the open road, being an individual.
Totally. Then, socially, there's this growing awareness about climate change and how gas-powered cars are hurting the environment, so that's pushing some people toward EVs. And then there's the technology. The U.S. has been a leader in EV tech, Tesla and all that, right?
Okay, but what about the legal and environmental stuff?
Legally, it's a mess. Different rules about charging stations, emissions, it's enough to make your head spin. And environmentally, even though EVs don't pollute on the road, we gotta think about the batteries. How do we make them sustainably? How do we dispose of them? It's complicated.
Okay, so the U.S. is a mixed bag when it comes to EVs. What about China?
China is a totally different story. Politically, they're all in on EVs. Mm-hmm. The government sets big goals. They give out tons of subsidies. It's way more government-driven than in the U.S.
So China's taking charge, literally, when it comes to EVs. Mm-hmm. What about the economics?
Well, China's the biggest car market in the world, and it's growing like crazy. Their middle class is expanding, and more people want cars. Plus, the Chinese government sees EVs as the future. They're putting a lot of money into research.
It makes sense. Being a leader in the EV market, that's a smart move economically. What about the social factors?
Air pollution is a huge problem in China, and people are starting to realize how bad it is for their health. EVs are seen as a way to fix that. Plus, it fits in with their whole thing about social harmony.
So for China, it's not just about being trendy, it's about the environment and the well-being of their citizens. What about the tech and legal side of things?
China's investing a ton in battery tech and building charging stations all over. And they're making cars more fuel efficient. Plus, they're encouraging ride sharing and electric public transit.
Wow, so they're not just focusing on one thing. They're tackling the problem from all angles.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to see how differently the U.S. and China are approaching EVs, even though it's the same technology.
Exactly. And that's where culture mapping comes in, right? It helps us see those connections, the data, the cultural values, the politics, all of it.
It's about understanding the why, not just the what. Okay, so we've seen how this works with something very real and tangible, like cars.
Yeah.
But what about something a bit more, I don't know, intangible, like beauty standards? We talked about South Korea before. How does culture mapping help us understand what's going on there?
It's interesting, right? You see this clash between the old and the new, like Confucianism. It's all about conformity, fitting in. And you see that in their beauty standards, historically at least, this preference for a very specific look.
So those beauty standards, they have a historical and cultural context. But now we're seeing this shift toward more individuality. How do we explain that using culture mapping?
We got to look at how globalization and social media have changed things. South Koreans, especially younger people, are exposed to all these different ideas about beauty now. And K-pop, that's been huge. K-pop stars, they have their own unique styles, and they're not afraid to challenge the old ways of thinking.
K-pop is like this cultural disruptor, creating space for something new.
Yeah.
Okay, what about Hofstede? How did that help us understand this shift in South Korea?
Even though South Korea has the history of collectivism, things are changing. Individualism, especially among young people, is on the rise. You can see it in everything. What they buy, their career goals, and yeah, how they express themselves through how they look. They'd rather stand out than fit in.
So we've got this tension between wanting to belong and wanting to be unique. And it's playing out in how people define beauty.
Exactly. And this is where the Johari window can be helpful, too. For a long time, the beauty industry in South Korea was all about this very narrow, very Western ideal of beauty. It created this blind spot where they weren't really acknowledging how diverse beauty actually is within Korean culture. And it was putting a lot of pressure on people.
So the Johari window helps us uncover those blind spots so we can have a more honest conversation about these issues.
Exactly. And that's what's starting to happen now. There's this movement toward body positivity, loving yourself for who you are, celebrating diversity.
It's like they're rewriting what it means to be beautiful.
Exactly. And it's not just about beauty. This shift is happening everywhere. Fashion, media, even politics. It's really changing South Korean society.
That's really incredible. It's amazing how we can use these tools like Pestle, Hofstede, and the Johari window to take something like beauty standards and see all these deeper meanings.
Everything's connected, and by understanding those connections, we can make sense of the world, and maybe even make it a little better.
Well said. Now let's talk about another area where we see a lot of change, education.
Education is fascinating because it's about how we shape the future, right? How we prepare the next generation.
Totally. So what are some of the big trends happening in education around the world, and how do different cultures approach these trends?
One big one is that people are realizing the old way of doing things, you know, memorizing facts, standardized tests, that's not cutting it anymore. The world's changing too fast.
Facts are important, but they're not enough. You need to be able to think critically, solve problems, be adaptable.
Right. And that's why we're seeing this move toward more personalized learning. Students get to have more of a say in what they learn, how they learn it, how fast they go.
It's about fostering curiosity, creativity, collaboration, all those skills that are harder to measure, but so important for success these days.
Exactly. But how these ideas play out in the real world, it depends on the culture.
Can you give me some examples?
Take Finland, for example. Everyone's always praising their education system, and for good reason. They prioritize student well-being, working together, a love of learning. They're not obsessed with standardized tests. They want kids to be able to think for themselves.
And that makes sense for them, right? It fits with their culture, equality, community, a love of nature.
Right. Now, compare that with South Korea. Their system is super competitive, very high pressure. That comes from their Confucian heritage, which values hard work and discipline.
So even though they're both trying to modernize, their approaches to education are different because their values are different.
Exactly. It's about understanding those nuances, those deep-seated values that shape everything.
It's fascinating to see how different cultures interpret these global trends in ways that make sense for them. Okay, we've talked about education. What else can we look at through the lens of culture mapping?
What about hotels? The hospitality industry in general is really interesting.
Okay, hotels. When it comes to luxury hotels, what are some of the big trends we're seeing?
Luxury is changing. It used to be all about fancy stuff and perfect service. But now, people want more. They want something real.
So thread count and those little chocolates on the pillow, that's not enough anymore.
Exactly. Today's traveler, especially younger generations, they want connection. They want to experience the local culture, connect with nature, feel like they're part of something bigger. Oh, and they want to Instagram it.
It's not just a vacation. It's got to be an experience.
Exactly. Hotels are catching on. They're offering super personalized stays, incorporating local culture, and promoting sustainability.
Can you give me an example of how culture mapping comes into play?
Okay, let's say a luxury hotel chain wants to open in Japan. They need to understand Japanese culture. Harmony, minimalism, tradition. So what do? Maybe they incorporate traditional design elements like shoji screens, tatami mats, things like that.
And offer experiences too, right? Like a traditional tea ceremony or a calligraphy class. Immerse guests in the culture.
Exactly. Or imagine a hotel in Costa Rica trying to attract eco-conscious travelers. Costa Ricans care about nature, so the hotel might be designed to blend in with the rainforest. They might use local materials. Maybe they offer tours with local guides.
It's about creating an experience that resonates with the place and the people.
Exactly. And that's what culture mapping is all about, making those connections, understanding those nuances.
It's like tailoring a suit, right?
Yeah.
You want it to fit the person perfectly.
Perfect analogy. Speaking of fitting in, let's talk about apartment living.
Okay, apartment living. With more people moving to cities, how is that changing how we design and experience these spaces?
The old way of thinking about apartments, you know, separate boxes for individual living, that's changing, especially with younger generations. They want community.
It's moved from me to we, right?
Exactly. Co-living is becoming super popular. Shared kitchens, workspaces, social events, all that. Especially in cities with a lot of young professionals.
It's like college dorms, but fancier.
Right. And there are a lot of reasons for it. Living in cities is expensive. Plus, more people are working remotely. And let's be honest, loneliness is a real problem, especially for young people.
So it's not just about saving money. It's about finding your people, a sense of belonging.
That's it. But again, it's different in different cultures.
Give me some examples.
In Japan, they already have a tradition of shared living. So they're experimenting with these really cool micro apartments. They're super functional and well-designed, but they still give you some privacy.
So they're taking this global trend and adapting it to their own cultural values.
Exactly. Then you've got Scandinavian countries. Yeah. Community is really important there. So they're building co-housing developments. These are private apartments, but they're clustered around shared spaces, gardens, that sort of thing.
It's like a little village in the middle of the city. It's amazing how these global trends are interpreted differently depending on the culture.
Exactly. And that's why understanding culture is so important, especially if you're designing spaces where people live, work, and interact. One size fits all. That doesn't work.
Definitely not. Okay, let's shift gears one last time. From physical spaces to the world of sports. What's changing there?
Well, our whole idea of what sport even means is evolving. Technology is a big factor, plus changing demographics, shifting values.
We've talked about esports. What else is changing the future of sport?
Personalization is huge. Athletes and fans, they want everything tailored to them. Wearable tech, personalized training plans, on-demand fitness content, you name it.
It's like we're moving away from this one-size-fits-all approach to fitness.
Exactly. We're also seeing all these niche sports and activities popping up. Things like parkour, bouldering, pickleball, you know. They offer a sense of community and challenge, but they're not your typical sports.
And a lot of them are about more than just competition. They're about being mindful, expressing yourself, connecting with people.
Totally. We're seeing a lot of interest in things like yoga, meditation, trail running. It's about the mind-body connection.
It's not just about being physically fit
anymore. Yeah.
It's about overall well-being. So how are these trends playing out in different cultures?
It really varies. Some cultures are still all about the traditional sports, you know, soccer, basketball. It's tied to national pride and identity. But in other cultures, you see this blending of old and new, martial arts with technology, dance mixed with athletic training. It's really cool.
It sounds like the world of sport is becoming as diverse as the world itself.
Absolutely. And culture mapping gives us the tools to make sense of it all.
It helps us see where we've been, where we are now, and where we might be headed.
Exactly.
This has been a great overview.
My pleasure.
So we've talked about a lot. EVs, beauty standards, education, even hotels. It's amazing how much culture influences our lives.
It's everywhere.
And to understand it all, we need culture mapping. It's not about predicting the future. It's about being prepared for it.
Exactly. It's about being curious, challenging our own assumptions, and appreciating how complex and wonderful human culture is.
I couldn't agree more. This deep dive has been eye-opening. I'm definitely going to be using these ideas in my own life.
That's great to hear. Just remember, it's a journey, not a destination. So keep learning, keep exploring. The world of culture is full of fascinating surprises.
And on that note, we'll wrap up this first part of our deep dive into culture mapping. Stay tuned for part two, where we'll dig even deeper.
We were talking about EVs in the US and China, right? Two totally different cultural landscapes, but both are dealing with the same tech shift.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to see how those different cultures are shaping how EVs are adopted.
Right. Like what works in one place might totally flop in another. So we talked about the US, that mix of government support, consumer demand, environmental concerns, all of that.
Yeah, it's a pretty complex picture over there.
Totally. But then you look at China and it's like night and day. They're just going for it full speed ahead.
The government's really putting their money where their mouth is, huh?
For sure. They're investing heavily in the technology, building charging infrastructure like crazy. And they've got these ambitious targets for EV adoption. It's a totally different approach, but it seems to be working for them.
It's interesting, right? Because in the U.S., we tend to think about things more from a market-driven perspective. You know, what do consumers want? But in China, the government plays a much more active role in shaping those consumer preferences.
Exactly. And that's a reflection of their cultural values, right? Their history, their political system, all of that feeds into how they approach something like EV adoption. It's not just about the technology itself. It's about how that technology fits into their broader societal goals.
It's like they're playing a long game, thinking about the big picture.
Exactly. And that's something we see across a lot of different industries and trends.
Speaking of which, I want to jump back to something you mentioned earlier about beauty standards. You talked about South Korea and this tension between traditional beauty standards and a desire for more individual expression.
Right, right. And how those tensions are playing out in really interesting ways. Like, on the one hand, you've got this long history of Confucianism, which emphasizes things like conformity and social harmony. And that's reflected in those traditional beauty standards, this preference for a very specific look.
Yeah, it's like those old school beauty standards are rooted in this desire to fit in, to not stand out too much.
Totally. But then, on the other hand, you've got this new generation that's growing up with globalization, with social media, with K-pop. They're exposed to all these different ideas about beauty, and they're not afraid to experiment, to express their individuality.
Yeah, K-pop has been huge in terms of pushing those boundaries, right? It's like they're rewriting the rules of what's considered cool and beautiful.
Right. And you can see how that ties into Hofstede's cultural dimensions, like individualism versus collectivism. South Korea traditionally has been a very collectivist culture, but we're seeing that shift, especially among younger generations. They're embracing individualism. And that's reflected in everything from their fashion choices to their career aspirations to how they choose to present themselves to the world.
It's like they're reclaiming their own narratives about beauty.
And challenging those older, more rigid ways of thinking. It's really fascinating to see how that's playing out, not just in South Korea, but globally.
And this is where the Johari window comes into play too, right?
Yeah.
We were talking about how the beauty industry in South Korea for a long time promoted this very narrow, often unattainable standard of beauty.
Right. And it created this blind spot, this lack of awareness about the diversity of beauty that actually exists within Korean culture itself.
It's like they were so focused on this one ideal that they weren't seeing the bigger picture, the beauty in all its forms.
Exactly. And that's what's so important about using tools like the Johari window. It helps us uncover those blind spots, those things we might not even realize we're missing.
So we can start to have more honest and inclusive conversations about beauty, about representation, about what it means to be comfortable in your own skin.
Exactly. It's about broadening our perspectives, challenging those old ways of thinking, and creating a more accepting and empowering culture for everyone.
Love it. Okay, so we've talked about EVs, beauty standards, all sorts of things through this lens of culture mapping. What other areas can we explore using these tools?
Honestly, the possibilities are endless. We could talk about education, about the future of work, about food, about how we design our cities. Culture touches everything.
It really does. And I think what's so fascinating is that these trends we're talking about, they're not just happening in a vacuum. They're all interconnected.
Exactly. Like, we can't talk about the future of work without talking about technology, about globalization, about changing demographics and cultural values. It's all intertwined.
And culture mapping gives us this framework, these tools, to start to make sense of it all.
It's like having a map to navigate this complex and constantly changing world.
I love that analogy, a map for the cultural landscape. Okay, so let's put this map to use. We've talked about some pretty big abstract concepts. How about we get a little more specific?
Sounds good to me. What do you have in mind?
Well, let's talk about something everyone can relate to. Let's talk about food.
You know, food is interesting because it's so central to culture.
Totally. Every culture has its own cuisine, its own traditions around food. It's like this universal language,
right,
but with a million different dialects.
Right. And just like with language, food evolves. We see new trends popping up all the time. But if we dig a little deeper, those food trends can tell us a lot about what's going on in a culture.
It's like food is a window into a culture's soul. So give me some examples. What are some food trends right now that are reflecting these larger cultural shifts we've been talking about?
Well, one big one is the rise of plant-based eating. It's huge right now, especially in the West.
Yeah, everyone's going vegan or vegetarian these days.
Right.
Or at least trying to eat less meat.
Exactly. And it's not just a fad. It's tied to some really important cultural shifts. People are concerned about their health, about animal welfare, about the environment. They're looking for more ethical and sustainable ways to eat.
It's like people are becoming more conscious of the impact of their food choices.
Right. And it's not just about individual choices either. This trend is shaking things up on a bigger scale.
How so?
Well, for one thing, it's creating a ton of innovation in the food industry. We're seeing so many plant-based meat alternatives now, things that actually taste good.
They've come a long way from those veggie burgers that tasted like cardboard, that's for sure.
You're right. And it's not just the fake meat. Restaurants are adding more vegan and vegetarian options to their menus. Grocery stores have whole aisles dedicated to plant-based products. It's crazy.
It's like the whole food system is adapting to this new way of eating.
Exactly. It's a great example of how these cultural trends can create real, tangible change.
So plant-based eating, that's a big one. What else?
Another trend we're seeing is the locavore movement. It's all about eating food that's grown or produced locally.
Farm to table.
Exactly. Again, there are a lot of reasons for this. People want to support their local farmers, reduce their carbon footprint, connect with where their food comes from.
It's about getting back to our roots, in a way, appreciating the connection between food, land, and community.
Exactly. And what's really interesting is that this trend is playing out differently in different parts of the world, depending on the cultural context.
Give me an example.
Well, take Japan, for example. They have this concept called shun, which is all about eating seasonal ingredients at their peak of freshness. It's been a part of their culinary tradition for centuries.
So in a way, they've been practicing the locavore ethos all along.
Exactly. It's just ingrained in their culture. And then you've got places like California, where the locavore movement is all about supporting small farms, organic agriculture, that sort of thing.
It's the same basic idea, but it's expressed in a way that reflects the local culture and values. I love that.
It's all connected. Culture shapes how we think about food, how we produce it, how we consume it. It's fascinating. Oh, and one more trend I wanted to mention, transparency.
Transparency, like knowing where your food comes from.
Exactly. People want to know what's in their food, how it was grown, who made it. They're demanding more information, more accountability from the food industry.
Which makes sense, right?
Right.
Especially with all the food scandals we've seen in recent years, people are losing trust in big food corporations.
Exactly. And technology is playing a big role here. Blockchain, for example, is being used to track food from farm to table so consumers can see the whole journey.
It's like giving people a peek behind the curtain.
Exactly. It builds trust and it connects people to the source of their food.
Wow, we've covered so much ground in this deep dive. It's amazing to see how all these different ideas and trends we've talked about, Pestle, Hofstede, the Johari window, culture mapping, how they all come together to help us make sense of the world around us.
It's all connected. And by understanding those connections, by seeing the world through this lens of culture, we can make more informed decisions, build stronger relationships, and create a more just and equitable future for everyone.
Beautifully said. And on that note, I think it's time to wrap up this deep dive. But before we go, I want to thank you, the listener, for joining us on this journey.
Thanks for listening.
We hope you've enjoyed this exploration of culture mapping as much as we have. And remember, the conversation doesn't end here. Keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep using these tools to navigate our increasingly complex and interconnected world. Until next time.